On the 19th of August 1996, about 2,000 workers, Indigenous activists and students pushed their way into the entry of Parliament House in Canberra, and thousands more cheered them on. They were angry with the new John Howard coalition government and its attacks on unions and workers' rights. They were also angry with the budget the government was to bring down the next day, that included privatisations, higher costs for university students, and cuts to Indigenous services and organisations. But the protesters came under attack by the government, the media, and even union leaders as an undisciplined mob that had rioted at the heart of the democratic system. Today we're launching a new segment as part of The Sound of Solidarity. It's called I Was There. And today and over coming months, we'll be interviewing activists who took part in key moments in the struggle. We'll be finding out what really happened and why the struggles took on the characteristics that they did. And importantly, we'll be asking, what can we learn for today to strengthen working class resistance and the campaigns for climate action, refugee rights, against the AUKUS Pact, and so on? Today, I'm talking to Solidarity member Tom Orsag, who was part of the protest at Parliament in 1996. Then, Tom was a teacher. Now he's a construction worker and a member of the CFMEU. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity. We're a revolutionary socialist group in Australia, and if you'd like to find out more about us, our website is solidarity.net.au. I'm David Glanz, and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Naam, or Melbourne. So welcome, Tom.
Thank you, David.
So, what happened that day in Canberra? Describe how things played out.
Well, the total number of people on the day would have been about 20,000 or 25,000. And the media the day after called it a riot, etc. I'm more likely to call it a festival of the oppressed, because you had this whole mixture of people, as you said, workers, Indigenous people, students, coming to Canberra to protest about the government's attacks on their living standards, on the right to organise, etc., etc. And they were angry because when Howard was elected in March, so what's that, you know, only a few months earlier, none of these things were campaigned for at the election. He had said, we are going to make a more comfortable and more relaxed Australia, no worker will be worse off. And look, that had an appeal after 13 years of Labor, when Labor was introducing all these neoliberal policies, privatisation, enterprise bargaining. And so when Howard turned around and did, you know, twice or three times worse, people were so angry. The trade union officials had organised this protest in Canberra. And when you have 20,000, 25,000 people on the hill, I don't know if people know that space, but it's huge. When you had that many people, the police and the parliamentary officials try to have what they call a designated protest area, which is about 750 metres down from that big forecourt you see on the news shows. And they kind of want people to be tidy and put people in this tidy little space. When you put that many working class people who are angry about what the government's doing, it just spilled over and went to the very front of the Parliament House, the great veranda, and people wanted to get in. People wanted to get in and tell the government what they thought about what they were doing. And, you know, it started about 11 or 12 in the morning, and it went till 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And so the area in the Great Veranda is a kind of tight space. Maybe you can fit 500, 1,000 people in between the portico and the front doors. So you couldn't get all 20, 25,000 people in there. But there would be people milling around, thousands of people trying to get... They got through the parliamentary gift shop. They got forced out by the police through that entrance. And then they managed to get a trolley from the shop. And that trolley was then used to try to wedge open the 17, 18 doors at the front. And so there's just milling around for hours, and it was just a really determined group of people, you know, and they'd be chanting, our house, let us in. So people's ideas are cast aside and what their actions are way ahead of their ideas. Our house let us in. So there's this belief that Parliament represents people's interests, etc. And, you know, Workers United will never be defeated. And just try to get in, and the union officials try to get people to go back to the designated protest area. More people would arrive on the day, and then they'd go up to the Great Veranda, then go back to the stage where, you know, Kim Beazley, the Labor Party leader, was, where Jenny Jord, who's the president of the ACTU, was, and oddly enough, Cheryl Kerner, who was the head of the Australian Democrats, who no longer exist. I came from a feeder march which started off at the railway station because a train had been put on by the unions from Sydney. It had been delayed because it was August and there was snow in the tracks in the Southern Highlands. And all these buses, there were steel workers from Wollongong who came by buses, miners, etc. And I read afterward, the Metalworkers Union of New South Wales had put on 47 buses. So we waited for that kind of contingent to arrive and marched up the 3 kilometres, it takes about half an hour to walk, and then it was already on. People were not at the designated protest area where they're supposed to be, but at the front doors of Parliament, the great veranda, trying to get in. So we're near the front of the march because we're locals, and the where do we go kind of thing. We just go this way and that way, and then you just see that great forecourt, and you know the designated protest areas to your right, and the great verandas to your left, and we're just going left. There's no argument about people. All of that march, which is thousands of workers, you know, been on trains and buses for hours, and just marched straight up into the great veranda, and then replenished the number of people who wanted to get in and could see what was happening, and understood that, you know, if they wanted to hang around, they could hang around.
And one of the triggers for all this was actually police racism against the Indigenous contingent.
Absolutely. I read about it afterwards because, you know, we bought the papers, every paper the next day to read about the thing. And there was even an honest thesis about it by a comrade at the time, Luke Deer. As I said, I come from the Kingston Railway March and that was late. And on the other side, on the western side of the Parliament, the CFMEU, the construction unions, students, and an Aboriginal march from the Tent Embassy had come up. And while the police had let through a contingent of public servants, they really handled roughly the Aboriginal march. And there was a union official in the community and public sector union, public servant union, called Kath Garvin, do nothing official, didn't lead strikes, didn't do anything, but she gets up on the stage and said, just letting people know that the Aboriginal people are being, you know, mistreated and mishandled by the police. So people from the designated protest area and the CFMEU, the Chevron's rushes forward to and surges forward to defend the Aboriginal people, and the police just get pushed aside. And the police then, you know, get their numbers from defending the front veranda to come in and help. They're swamped, and everyone heads for the front doors from the western side of the great veranda. And now Kath Garvin never did anything subsequently after that, but that speech was just like, you know, absolutely accidental, and got more people involved and disrupted a very kind of like stage army theatrical, you know, here's his speeches, listen to speeches and go home kind of thing.
To get 20 or 25,000 workers from New South Wales and Victoria and probably a few from beyond to Canberra is a big deal. It doesn't happen easily. It doesn't come out of thin air. So the ACTU and state Labor councils had been campaigning for months, and there'd also been quite a number of strikes taking place. So what was the background to this mobilisation?
Well, as I said, Howard gets in on the basis of I'm going to do nothing to disrupt people's lives. We're going to have peace and quiet after all this 13 years of Labor turmoil, etc. And then proceeds to, you know, cut back on everything, Aboriginal services, make students pay more for their education, and really importantly, introduces the Workplace Relations Bill, which it's 500 pages long, and it's basically, you know, a lawyer's picnic. They sat down and, you know, what are the do's and don'ts, and how can we constrain the union movement to stop them doing any routine basic organising, basic and maintenance of union organisation. So they create this bill, which is 500 pages long, which is going to strip unions of their power to organise their membership and call strikes around not just economic questions, but political questions. And that's what the Liberals have always hated, workers going on strike any time for economic rights, but for political rights, because you've got a whole history in this country of workers taking actions against apartheid, Indonesian occupation of East Timor, uranium mining, French nuclear testing, whatever. They hated that. And so they create this law which even, you know, wants to limit the union's ability to take industrial action around political questions. The union officials, this is an attack on their very core existence. And so they start to campaign amongst the membership. They hold delegates meetings. Telstra had a strike against privatisation of Telstra. 11,000 workers in Telstra go on strike. There's delegates meetings in Melbourne and 1,500 in Sydney and so on and so forth. Those delegates meetings then go back to the workplaces, campaign amongst the membership. This is a massive attack. This is a terrible attack. We weren't expecting this, and it's going to hamper the union. And so they do this, month after month from March to August, and August was then when the budget was. So people take the union officials at their word. This is a massive attack. So, what are we going to do about it? Well, we're going to fight this. So there's a series of strikes. The CPSU nationally has a series of stoppages because there's government cutbacks to the public servants' jobs, etc., etc. So this goes on for months and months. And then they start booking buses for Canberra. A train, the whole train was called the Spirit of Protest, left from Sydney, filled up with union members. So you've now got the union officials mobilising members to fever pitch almost. The government is attacking us. We have to fight back. And so it's all directed to Canberra the day before the budget. And we're going to show Howard that he really has no mandate, because that's the other thing. There's this whole question of, well, if you campaign around these questions at election time, then you have a mandate because you've told people up front, this is what we stand for. Howard mentioned none of this.
Now, the idea of a national mobilisation to Canberra, and there were state-based strike rallies as well, by today's standards, seems really, really militant, the good old days. But even then, the ACTU and the officials were quite upfront. They didn't expect, in fact, they weren't aiming to stop the Workplace Relations Bill. They were aiming to amend it, and they were aiming to influence what we would now call the crossbench, the senators in Parliament who potentially could block part of the legislation. So in those days, it would have been the Greens and, as you say, the Australian Democrats. So why would the officials mobilise in a way that we haven't seen for quite some while in Australia, but at the same time focus on essentially trying to get senators to block part of the legislation?
Well, that speaks to the very heart of what we call reformism or reformism, that they want to mobilise their members and they use their members as a stage army, but the arguments that they prosecute and the arguments they want to win workers to are very conservative and very self-limiting. So we're going to lobby the Senate, we're going to lobby the Democrats, the people who have the balance of power in the Senate, we're going to get rid of some of the, smooth some of the rough edges of the legislation, et cetera, et cetera. And they do that today. I mean, in my union, the CFMEU, when they introduced the Australian Building Construction Commission, which is the extra legal body which polices only the building industry, they say, we're going to lobby the senators. So it's their standard practice. They've been doing that now from 96 till now for 25 years. It's just their conservative worldview. They limit themselves to only trying to get amendments and their respectability, and they don't want to embarrass the Labor Party. The Labor Party is going to be a government one day, and Jenny George at one point says we're going to have, who's the president of the ACTU at the time, comes from the New South Wales Teachers Federation. She says we're going to have a long campaign, and that dovetails into the Labor Party's thing. We're going to fight them in the next election. And so they want to show that they're respectable. They want pave the way for the Labor Party getting back in. So they tailor their arguments to the most conservative elements.
There's also that element in reformism where the union leaders see their role as organising around economic issues, and it's the job of the Labour Party to organise around political issues. So union officials are quite nervous about organising and mobilising around political issues. They see it as part of a process of getting Labour elected. So that feeds into the situation.
I mean, that's right. You've got two, the reformism is two wings. The trade union wing is one section of it, and the Labour Party is the other wing of it. And they do have a kind of a wall, a dividing wall between that says, you know, trade union officials look after economic questions and the Labour Party looks after political questions. That's not true in the real world. You know, if workers go on strike, they have to deal with the political aspects of the laws that hamper their strikes and picketing and secondary boycotting. So any strike is, economic strike, is inherently political because you have to deal with these political questions. But in the Labour Party and reformism codifies this division between economics and politics that doesn't exist in real life. It codifies that the officials are the ones who look after economics and the Labour Party looks at politics. And you can see that today. That's reflected in COVID today with Dan Andrews having the lockdowns. Union officials in Victoria have not challenged lockdowns, any question of politics about health, etc., to them, vaccine mandates, etc., etc. It's we're officials, we just do the economics and let the Labour Party do the politics. And so they don't challenge the political decisions, which actually have a direct economic effect on the workforce.
After that day's events, predictably, the media went crazy, calling it a riot, implying that everybody were mindless militants, and in particular, putting the blame for the events back on the ACTU and on the Labour Party. Because as you say, the president of the ACTU and the leader of the Labour Party were 750 metres away, waiting for people to come and hear their words of wisdom. And the ACTU and the Labour Party and pretty much all union officials surrendered to that argument and effectively, well, in many cases, did apologise and made it clear that they had no intention of repeating that kind of exercise ever again. How did the far left respond to those accusations at the time?
You're right about the media kind of hue and cry about the riot and how undemocratic and un-Australian, and Howard jumped in. Howard just saw this as an opportunity to kind of criticise the Labour Party for having allowed this to happen, criticise the ACTU officials, and really wanted to intimidate them to the point where, you know, you are not going to call another protest, you're not going to organise this thing, we're running the country now, and therefore there's not going to be any fight back, you can't organise any fight back. The far left at the time was quite small. We were arguing that we had the right to protest, we had the right to be there, and that, in a sense, that the Liberals are asking the ACTU to do something that they can't do. You know, the ACTU doesn't, you know, sometimes, you know, has this idea that workers are a stage army and all these people are a stage army and they wheel them out and look how scary they are and the Liberals will back down. But they don't control them like a stage army. People have all their anger and passion and bitterness and everything that's stored up prior to any event, and they bring it with them. And the officials can't control working class anger about, you know, they get officials telling them this is the worst attack, the laws are terrible, the cutbacks are terrible. People take it seriously. Okay, if it's so terrible, let's go get them. Let's break into Parliament and show them how serious we are. You know, we said it was a good thing that, you know, the working class fought industrially and on the day that, you know, their anger boiled over. And that anger is totally understandable and totally expected. This is the thing that struck me about the day. You can't put 20 to 25,000 of the best working class militants and all sorts of other people on the hill and not expect them to take their anger out. You can't expect them to act as a stage army. You've got them to the point where people are so disappointed that we're not going to be comfortable and relaxed, that there's going to be another round of we have to fight, that they want to keep going.
And of course, there's also the argument that Yes, the protesters caused a little bit of property damage. A few commemorative parliamentary pens got knocked off shelves in the gift shop. But compared to the damage that the Liberal government was about to carry out on the working class in terms of privatisation, attacks on Aboriginal organisations, the big increases to the cost of higher education for students, and the Workplace Relations Bill, which became the Workplace Relations Act and later on became Work Choices, was a frontal assault on the ability, as you say, of unions to operate, which meant workers were going to end up worse off. So the media will always focus on the actions of the militant minority and play up the property damage, but the real damage is being done by the Liberal government and its attacks.
Absolutely. And they were just going to do that year after year. It wasn't just, I mean, part of the thing is that capitalism is relentless. It's a treadmill. Once they're happy with one section of cutbacks being implemented, etc., and bedded down, okay, what can we do next? What other thing? How else can we limit workers' ability to organise, limit ordinary people's, how do we get more money out of them? I read Amanda Vanstone, who's there, the education minister, said, "Oh, the cost of university fees that we're charging, it's no more than the price of a new car." I mean, these people live in this world where it's just so easy. I mean, what's everyone complaining about? And they would be relentless, because within 2 years, Liberals, under John Howard and Peter Reith, who's an industrial relations minister, attacked the maritime unions of Australia, not just the whole union movement, but a specific section of the union movement, which they absolutely hate and which is absolutely central to the Australian economy, because Australia is an island and everything comes from shipping. So it was relentless. They were going to do this and they were going to continue doing this. So people's anger about what was happening was totally justified. In fact, rather than buckling to the pressure, the ACTU should have called more protests and more activity, because it wasn't just for the 1 year of the Liberal government.
Now, in the 96 election where Howard came to office, Pauline Hanson was elected. Technically, she was elected as a Liberal candidate, but obviously, as we know, she went on to found One Nation and become one of the most significant racist leaders in recent Australian history. To what extent do you think the retreat of the ACTU and the Labor Party after the events at Parliament House opened up a political vacuum that made it easier for Hanson to grow One Nation? Because she was tapping in to some of that anger. She was giving it a racist coloration, but she was tapping into some of that working class anger that Howard had tapped into, but also that the ACTU had tapped into. So as the ACTU stepped back, One Nation was it made it easier for them to step forward. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Oh, absolutely. The riot happened in August, and Hanson gives her maiden parliamentary speech in September. And it is full of the most racist dribble you'll ever see, and distortion of facts and figures and numbers and everything. And the media loved it. The media covered her like she was this, speaking words of wisdom, etc. Howard gave cover for her because he said, "Oh, I don't want, restrain anyone from political correctness. The days are over." And but from that period, from August, September 96 to the attack on the MUA in April 98, the left and, that includes the far left and Labor Party people and all sorts of unaffiliated people, was spent fighting Hanson, building an organisation in the end of 96, 97, that retreat by the ACTU did open up that space. So the left fighting, the building of One Nation, and every racist and Nazi, and there's pictures of Hanson, talking to young skinheads with swastikas tattooed on their head in the newspapers. Every racist and Nazi gravitated towards One Nation, because here now was a party of open racist filth, open degradation of minorities, and etc. etc. And there was no opposition, parliamentary opposition. There was no respectable opposition. The media covered it. So that retreat meant that we were fighting against the building of a hardcore racist party for 16, 18 months.
We've mentioned the maritime dispute a couple of times. Now, on the face of it, in 1996, Howard was the big winner out of the so-called riot. The Labour Party retreated, the ACTU retreated, they essentially called off their campaign of resistance to Howard's attacks. They apologised for what had happened. They crawled in order to supposedly avoid blame. So Howard was the winner. He had his parliamentary and his union opposition on their knees. And yet, 2 years later, we saw massive mobilisations around the country on the picket lines to defend the Maritime Union of Australia. Some of the same officials who were apologising in 96 were on the picket line in 98. And there was a very real sense that we were moving in the direction of a general strike. That's my reading of the situation at the time. We didn't get there, but we were moving in that direction. So how do we explain how things turned around from the officials grovelling and apologising in 96 to the movement openly mobilising and blockading the ports in massive numbers? What happened?
I think there's two elements to it. Firstly, there's an underlying anger against neoliberalism and the cutbacks throughout the whole of the 90s. There's a recession in 91. And one of the things that the Labour Party under Hawke and Keating thought, well, there won't be any more recessions. We're going to manage capitalism. Everything's going to be okay. You had this recession in 91. And then you had the election of, say, particularly vicious Liberals in Victoria. Jeff Kennett becomes the Premier of Victoria. Again, doesn't say what his program is, but soon after he's elected, we're going to be cutting health, education, and those health cuts has ramifications for COVID to this day. Victoria's health system is so much worse because of what Kennett did in 92. The secretary of the Victorian Trades Law Council was then a guy called John Halfpenny. He, within a month of Kennett saying that he was going to do all this, after he hadn't said it in the election campaign, Halfpenny calls a protest rally and strike for November 1992. It's absolutely huge. 150,000 people in Melbourne, maybe 400,000 on strike, rallies in regional centres, Bendigo, you know, Ballarat, Geelong, etc., the Latrobe Valley. So there's an underlying anger about the cutbacks going back from 92. I mean, you also said about the low paid. Howard won, anyone who earned under 30,000 was appealed to. Howard talked about his Howard Battlers, the section of Western suburbs in Sydney voted for the Liberals that normally they would vote for Labor in the federal election. So there were sort of litmus test seats, icon seats like Lindsay, Reid, etc., etc. And that's the thing the Liberals wanted. They wanted these working class people to vote for them, vote for cutbacks, etc. So there's an underlying anger, and it's looking for a way to get out. Against neoliberalism, against all the cutback, against privatisation. That's the first element. The second element is the officials give in and call the Liberals and capitulate it. But when it comes to 98, Howard is overconfident and goes, right, well, we've got the workplace relations in place. We've bedded down all these attacks. We're just going to go in the next thing on our agenda. And they overplay their hand. The officials, you know, might have got their hands burnt over the Canberra riot, but they weren't going to allow one of their key unions to be defeated by, you know, when the Liberals did the attacks, they had security guards in balaclavas, dogs on the wharfs, etc., etc., locked out the workforce. The officials weren't going to let this happen. And so again, they start this process of organising membership, getting the wizard of the trade union bureaucracy move very slowly. But when there's something important to the centre of their ability to organise and unionise, they mobilise their membership. And so they start to say, well, Howard's gone too far. This is un-Australian what he's doing, and we are going to fight back. And so then they begin to tap into that underlying anger and turn it against Howard. And so, and people responded to it. You know, I was still in Canberra there in 98, and we were doing street collections for the MUA, and all these public servants were throwing money into, you know, bills into our buckets, because they knew if the MUA, a blue collar, powerful blue collar union, was defeated, their white collar union would easily be defeated. So they were, they, you know, it was very easy to support the MUA, collect for money for them, and raise a political argument that, you know, that workers had to support the MUA against Howard and Rees' attack.
So Howard might have won the political argument in 96, but at the end of the day, the class struggle has a way of bringing people back onto the front line. So more than 25 years now have passed since that crisp morning.
Very crisp.
Yeah. Very crisp morning in Canberra. Winter in Canberra, always a delight. More than 25 years since you were at that protest. You were one of the thousands trying to push your way into Parliament in 1996. How would you summarise the experience, and what advice coming out of that would you give to younger activists today?
Every campaign, every fight back is inherently political. And there's always going to be a conservative argument. The most conservative thing, you know, will lobby senators, do this and do that. And the left has to, you know, win some people and win the arguments that those arguments hold back the campaign, hold back the movement, whether it's refugees or climate change or whatever issue. So politics is always to the fore. But if you don't win, like we didn't win in 96. We didn't get through the front doors. In fact, we'd been there for hours, and at the end we'd open all the doors and people had started to leave, and then the riot police came out with truncheons and, you know, scared everyone away from the veranda with the truncheons. This is actually quite a scary situation. We didn't win on the day, but then, as you say, the class struggle comes back in 2 years. The officials find their bottle there. They find that they, you know, they're going to defend their union, and you have a chance to beat Howard in 98. So you don't give up. You keep fighting. You keep arguing for the way to win, and the tide will turn for you. And the other thing is that if the other side does win, they become over optimistic. And so when Howard lost the battle, the MUA, they didn't attack any union frontally from 98 onwards. And they used other ways to, you know, redistribute wealth to their support base. But when he won the election, I don't know, what is it, the one where he had the majority, he could introduce work choices, he overstepped the mark. And then the ACTU mobilised your rights at work campaign, and from 2004 to 2007, and got rid of him. But the argument that, you know, you should have a long campaign, et cetera, is an essentially, you know, conservative one. We can win battles and we can win fights, but only if we have the politics to say we can win them today and not tomorrow, and not rely on a Labor government. We can be confident that our side can bounce back. See, there's a chain of continuity, as I've talked about, 92 with Kennett, the riot in 96, the MUA in 98. There's a chain of continuity. And unless our side suffers a massive, massive defeat, and we're talking, you know, Chile 1973 or whatever, they can't beat us. There's a chain of continuity that they can't break. And our side will always bounce back, you know. And I think you've seen in the COVID era, they need us more than we need them. You know, the essential workers, anyone involved in the supply chain, etc., etc. They need us. We don't need them.
All right. Thanks very much, Tom.